Hi, I'm Will Stein and welcome to Geography Island Jams. This podcast is in the same style as the BBC Radio 4 series Desert Island Discs, whereby in each episode I ask my interviewee what 8 songs, book and luxury item they would take with them if they are stranded on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music has not been included in this podcast. You can find links to the songs either on the Geography and Environment website or on the Geography Island Jams Spotify music account. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Geography Island Jams. Joining me today, I have Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Joe Gance. Joe is known for his work that examines personal stories with honesty, humour and depth. His film style, called Life in Progress, allows subjects to be comfortable enough to go about their daily lives as if no one was filming. His credits include Taxi Cab Confessions, American Winter and Ending Disease. His latest film, The Race to Save the World, illuminates the human stories in the fight for climate action. Rather than focusing on scary statistics and abstract predictions, the feature follows a range of environmental campaigners of all ages who are prepared to sacrifice everything in order to save the world. So welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Will.
So yeah, I just wanted to ask how familiar you are with what's meant to be happening to you, how you're going to be stranded on an island, nothing more, with your songs, book and luxury. How do you think you'd cope being in your own company on a deserted island?
I don't think I'd cope super well. I like to be around people, my family mainly. I don't think I would love to be all alone for long periods of time. Although when I was in my 20s, I did live in a teepee in Vermont for 2 summers with just my dog and no songs.
Nice.
we cooked over an open fire. I say we because after you spend long enough with your dog, you talk in the plural. So I have done that, but that was a long time ago.
I've got lots of questions about the film. I think first, if you can give me the first song you'll be taking with you and if there's any reasons why you've chosen it.
Well, I guess the first one on this list is it's a song by Ry Cooder. It's called Down in Mississippi. It's a blues song, a really powerful song. And he also, and as my second song in here, How Can a Poor Man Stand Such Times and Live? Both blues songs, really good. Ry Cooder's an amazing guitarist, slide guitarist, and those are 2 of my 8.
I've studied geography, so I have lots of films which focus on the environment, climate change, and other related issues, but I think this is the first film, at least I've heard of, which focuses on the climate change activists themselves. And so my first question was, what inspired you to want to do a film documentary focused on the climate change activists?
Well, so when climate change films first started coming out, I mean, I think the first one I saw was Al Gore's film. People didn't really know what was in store with climate change. They didn't know how climate change was going to change our world. And so it was very important that people, you know, saw some of these films and got oriented and figured this out. But after, you know, many years of this, the information on climate change is sort of in the ether now. People know generally what's in store, and it's frightening. It's overwhelming. So another climate change film will come out that tells you, you know, how bad things are and how much worse they're going to get. And people, I think it's just almost too depressing to watch. I sometimes feel like I should watch that film, but it's just, I've heard this before. Do I really need to subject myself? So I feel that my style of filmmaking, which I call Life in Progress, where I choose my subjects and then I fade into the background. I try to capture the important moments as well as the everyday moments and then kind of tell their story in a way that, you know, shows their lives, their relationships. I thought that this could be something that would be more energizing and inspiring because, you know, when you follow these activists, these are folks who can't tune it out, who don't have that option. It's just they have no choice but to jump in there, do what they can. They're in the trenches and trying to do everything they can to turn this around. And so it's really inspiring rather than depressing.
Yeah, for sure. And I've got more questions about the filming style. But first, I saw there were other Gansers involved in the production of the film. What was it like making the film with your family, I assume?
Yeah, so my son David edited the film. And my son Nathan did the music. And David edited my previous film on stem cell research and regenerative medicine, which is called Ending Disease. And Nathan, who's younger, 6 years younger than David, was coming home from college, driving home from college where he was going in Santa Cruz, California. And that film, I had kind of worked with a composer before, and he was trying to charge me money for, he was trying to charge me money, but I was saying, can I pay you later? I need to finish this film. And I'd worked with him before, the composer who I was scheduled to work with. And he said, no, I don't want to, you to pay me later. I've worked doing this a long time. Your film might not sell, blah, blah, blah. So I called up my son, Nathan, who was in the car driving home from college. I said, Nathan, I've got a job for you this summer if you're up for it. And so he was a composing major and he'd done his own music. But he'd never done music for a film, but he did an excellent job, I felt.
So now I wanted to ask about your filming style. Can you explain a bit more about what Life in Progress means and when did you first film in this style?
So I've been making documentary film and television for 30 years. And my approach is, as I said, to choose the subjects, fade in the background, and let their life evolve organically, and then put the story together in the editing. I tried to be around for the kind of big events, the momentous moments, if possible, as well as the everyday moments. And I think people are revealed through their everyday moments as well as the more impactful moments that happen. But my documentaries are harder to make because A, I'm committed to being around a lot. So most people who make documentaries, they want to be there for a moment that they pretty much feel is going to get into the film because it's expensive, it's exhausting, it's time consuming, but I feel like I have to be there over and over again so people get comfortable with me and my crew being around. And after a while with me being around, it also makes people very relaxed with having us there so they can kind of just be themselves. And I think that when you do this type of Life in Progress, it's almost like a fictional film where a fictional film, they write the scenes. And of course you're there during those scenes when they happen because they script them. But I commit to being there during important moments. And on this particular film, that was very hard because these are often direct action, civil disobedience events, and they want to keep that quiet till the last minute so that the authorities don't hear about it and maybe do something to block it. So here I am needing to go across the country with a crew, and I'm being told at the last minute sometimes. So it was very hectic and difficult. And but in the end, I think it becomes very authentic when you do this way. You feel, the viewer feels like they're there for something that's happening in a very authentic way.
Yeah, the authenticity definitely came through. I felt that. I think it's just so hard to capture. So when you just mentioned before, you were told things last minute, can you give me any examples of like a very close shave, like when you had a really close, a quick turnaround time?
Well, yeah, there were protests that were happening. And, you know, there was protests that were happening, and they would say, you know, it's going to happen, but I don't know when. And often I felt that they did know when, but they just weren't letting me know when. And then, you know, for the when the Shell oil rig was leaving the port of Seattle for the Arctic, I was even in Seattle because I was told that it was going to happen soon. And so I brought my crew up there and I was there. But, you know, they told the kayaktivists who, you know, you have this Shell oil rig that is essentially as big as an 11-story building. And then you have these tiny kayaks that are trying to block its way. And they call themselves the Mosquito Fleet. And so we wanted to film that. And I had hired a sailboat that had a motor on it. This was the only boat I could find. And we were going to be out there. But, you know, I didn't find out quite as soon as I needed to. We had to rush out we got woken up at about 4 a.m, but we didn't get there till 5. But the kayaktivists had gotten out an hour earlier. And so it was chaos at times. And there was also a factor that I had to deal with in this film that I didn't have to deal with in any of my previous films, because these are activists who are doing civil disobedience and direct action. And so they have a sense in their community of the people who are working together towards their goals. And here comes this person from Los Angeles. And Los Angeles is looked at a little bit like, you're from Los Angeles, huh? You know, it's like the media is in Los Angeles in many ways, but I am not the media. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I work alone. I don't really know anybody else in the media. I don't hang out with anybody in the media. I work on my own very independently. But you know, here I was going into a group of people that have been working together in very intense situations for years, perhaps. And I show up with a professional looking crew coming from Los Angeles. And I am, you know, perhaps older than some of the people. And so there was a question like, you know, who is this guy? And, you know, is this someone we can trust? And they also is a kind of in most of these groups, there's a unanimous assessment of things. So I showed up, for instance, at FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington, D.C., the day before a big protest was supposed to happen, and they were sort of practicing, but they had to ask the group to okay me being there. And it was a group of about 50, 60 people, wow. And it had to be unanimous. And one person seemed to have a problem with it. There weren't, you know, in that group, I was following like 3 subjects, and those were my main subjects. But there was like 50, 60 people, and one person who was not a main subject was seemed to be very much against this. And luckily, that person seemed to be not the most respected people in the group, and they did override his complaint that we shouldn't allow me to be a part of it. But you know, you go across the country, you've invested all this money, and all the money was raised by nonprofit donations. You know, you take a risk and you can get there and can fall through. So.
But yeah, what you touched on there, I wanted to ask more questions about that, because in the film, you dive deep into the climate change activists' lives. Like, you go into their homes, you follow them when they're at really vulnerable points. How do you gain their trust? Like, what do you have any advice or ways of approaching people? Because as you said, you know, you come out, you know, not part of the group originally. So I imagine it's quite challenging in order to infiltrate a group which is that tight.
Yeah, it is difficult. And so a lot of it has to do with picking the right people. I sometimes joke that there's 3 rules to documentary filmmaking: casting, casting, and casting. If you pick the right people who are open and trusting and able to be themselves in a situation like, you know, us filming, it can really be very personal and honest and powerful. If you pick people who aren't like that, who some people consciously or unconsciously want to direct this film and give you what they think they want you to see, if you find yourself in that situation, it's not easy. So the first thing is to get the right people. And when I do a documentary film like this, I usually follow twice as many people as end up in the film, because you never know for sure. In this case, there's 7 people in the film. So following, you know, 14 people or so over the course of this 6 years, 5 or 6 years I made this film, you know, it was, you know, I made a few, you know, wrong turns and had to adjust. And you know, I think the people who are in this film are, you know, amazing. And we're able to establish a trust together. And you know, there's something very charismatic and powerful about their approach to activism and their kind of approach to fighting climate change that I think is going to be inspiring. But you have to get the right people.
So you may have mentioned a new example previously, but which group or person, if you feel comfortable saying, but was the hardest to get in contact with and to be able to film?
Well, I think the people who are in the group were pretty trusting. Of the people in the group, I would say Mac and his girlfriend, Sean, were sort of the ones who were like not so sure. Maybe Sean more than Mac, but I had a situation where I came to Anacortes, Washington, which is north of Seattle, and there's a big oil plant there, whatever you call it, oil refinery there. And they were having a weekend of protests. And I was following one of the people who didn't get into the film. It was a 90-year-old woman. And her name was Shirley, and she would chain herself to a rocking chair at certain places. She actually got arrested like a dozen times over the course of, you know, many years. And I got up there. I had talked to her and the 1,000 grannies that she belongs to. It's an organization. And when I arrived in that town with my crew, the people who were setting up the protest wouldn't tell me where she was. And, you know, I had gone all the way up there. And I said, well, why wouldn't you do that? And they said, because she wants to be filmed, but there's a lot of people here who don't. I said, well, I won't film anyone who doesn't want to be filmed. And they said, well, we don't know that. And they wouldn't tell me where she was. And I didn't get to film that. So it was a long struggle making this film. And, you know, but the people who are in it were great to work with. But it was not always easy.
And then did you have any tips for finding the right people? So you said it's very, in order to get, trustworthy people, it's all about finding the right ones. But in terms of finding them or approaching, were there any tips to that?
Well, you mean if someone wants to be a documentary filmmaker, how do they choose the right people? Well, that's a good question. I don't know if there's anything I could write down in a list. If, like, you told me I'm going to make a film, how do I know the right people from the wrong people? I think it's more intuitive. But I would say it's also, you know, the way you work with them, because you can turn a good person into a bad person to work with if you like pushing them to, you know, do things when that's not their comfort level. The thing that I do that I think establishes trust is that I never try to tell people what to do or say. I try to stay in the background and let things happen organically. And you can say that, but you really have to do that. So if you are there and they think this person has an objective and they're trying to make me do this or that. But then you're working with them two or three times and you just basically let them say and do whatever comes naturally. After a while, they realize that they're free to be themselves and they go back to being themselves. So that would be my advice. But most people don't do this because you have to commit to being there many times that you know you won't use that footage, and to commit a crew and go and put your time and money into being there, knowing that, you know, half the time you're with them, it'll never get in the film. Most people don't want to commit to that. So.
And then, so films like this, as we mentioned at the beginning, can be great in bringing light on certain issues, which will ultimately influence government and creating policy. So one of your previous works, American Winter, was a significant part of the movement towards raising minimum wage. Is there anything which you or the activists hope for to come from when this film is released?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot at stake here. I mean, you're a young man, and the ways that the climate is going to change and affect your life are profound. And so there's tremendous amount at stake. And I am hoping that this film will inspire and energize people to get involved, to take action. And, you know, the people in this film, they're taking action and, you know, putting themselves on the line in ways that, you know, do risk arrest and sometimes risk arrests for more than a few days in jail. But I don't think that is necessary. But I do think it's necessary that people take action. It may be slightly different in your country, or more than slightly different, but in this country, I would say 65-70% of this country knows that climate change is going to impact everyone's lives. In fact, is impacting everyone's lives now, and wants to do something about it. But it's maybe only 20% of politicians, because they're paid off. And so the fact is that until the politicians commit to the kind of spending that it's going to take to make the changes that will have an impact on the climate, there's not much that the average person can do. But the politicians are not going to make those changes unless millions of people make their voices heard. And it's said in the film by Mark Kurtzgaard that during the Nixon administration, there was 20 million people in the streets, and that had an important impact on the first climate regulations that were done at that time. And we need to do that again, because the politicians are not going to act without that. And Biden is saying that he's going to make big changes in a way that helps fight climate change. But his infrastructure bill has many things that are supposed to be furthering that end. But people are saying that to bring down the temperature in the long run, it's going to take, in the United States alone, $1 trillion of investment every year for the next 10 years. Well, this is very small compared to that. So we really have to make it clear that the people are not going to stand for some token gesture, some symbolic gesture that is not going to affect change. And until people make their voices heard and get into the street, no one has to get arrested. If you don't want to, you can. It can be helpful, but you don't have to get arrested. You don't really even have to protest. You can call your congressman. You can do other things as well. But the choice is not there to do nothing, in my opinion. You have to take some action that shows that you're committed and that you make your voice heard for a change.
So I just wanted to follow up. what can people do to get their voices heard? So as you said, you can call up your congressman in the UK, you can call your MP, you know, you can protest. So what other things can people do to make sure their voices are heard about, you know, they want an improvement to how we treat our environment?
Well, you know, there's many things depending on your part of the country, where you live and what's going on. I actually think that protests are pretty fun. They're energizing. My first protest I went to, I was 16 years old. I had just learned to drive. It was during the Vietnam War. There was a lot of protesting going on, and there was I'd never been to a protest, and there was a protest in Washington, D.C. that I heard about. I lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is, I would say, maybe a 10-hour drive or so. And I heard that they said they were going to do a thing called, if the government won't stop the war, we'll stop the government. And they were blocking all the roads into Washington, D.C. I remember I went to my parents and I said, I'd like to go to this protest. Can I go there? And they said, absolutely not. First of all, you just learned to drive. And second of all, it's dangerous. You cannot go. So I took the car and my friend and I went to Washington and for the weekend, and we protested and we came back. And, you know, protests are, they're fun. They're, you know, back then, you know, there was, you know, great music, there's great clothes, you know, and it's energizing. Many people say in this film that the antidote for depression is to take action. And I do feel that that is very true. And so, you know, going to a protest, I don't know if fun is the exact right word, but it's exciting and energizing. And there are many other things you can do. I mean, if you're around Bill Moyer, you can be in part of his kayak fleet. If you're somewhere else, you know, there's other things that people do in other parts of the country. There's on our website, there's a bunch of different organizations that you can click on to see ways to get involved. You know, there's all levels.
And so I know you're still in the midst of releasing the film, which comes out 22nd of April. Is that right? World Earth Day?
Yes.
And I'm jumping ahead a bit, but do you have any plans for what's next? Do you have a next project in mind?
No, not exactly. I mean, I do have a project I'm developing, but it's pretty early on. I've been making these two films, one for 5 years and one for 6 years. And I made the films and I raised the funds completely, more or less from cold calls and cold emails. And it was exhausting and overwhelming. And I can't believe actually I finished them both. And in the midst of that, just as I was finishing up the edit on Ending Disease, I was diagnosed with bladder cancer. So that was quite a shock. And then my son, David, had said he didn't want to edit the second film. He wanted to work on his own things. But once I got diagnosed, he came back and he edited that film as well. And I'm doing fine. I'm doing great. It turned out to be low grade bladder cancer. There's high grade and low grade. And for the first 6 months, they told me I had high grade. And then they said, oops, we made a mistake. You have low grade. So that was good. But a lot's been going on. And then I don't know if you're aware of it, but there was a pandemic. And so, yeah, I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to focus on. I do have a couple of things I'm juggling, but we'll see. I'll take a breath.
Well, finally, something which you hopefully can be more certain on is your fifth song. Can you tell me about the song number five or whatever you've got in that?
Yeah, the fifth song is Michael Jackson, Who's Loving You? It's also a blues song.
There's definitely a theme going on. So now my next few questions are more about you. So I imagine being a filmmaker, you've traveled all over the US, all over the world. Do you have any favorite places which you've been to?
Well, I lived in Paris for 5 years, most of the time in my late 20s and early 30s. I met my wife there. I love Paris. I spent a lot of time in London. I had a good friend there, Chris Titterington, who's an artist. So I spent a lot of time in London and other places in Europe. So I love France. If Trump had been elected again, I might have moved there with my family. I could not have envisioned another 4 years of Trump. That would have been the end of democracy. He pretty much did his best to destroy democracy during his 4 years. So I would say that would be where I would consider living.
And then what about, is there anywhere in the world which you've not been to, which you're most keen to go and see?
Oh, well, I haven't been to a lot of places because, I've been involved in working and whatnot. So there's a ton of places I'd like to see. And I've been to Japan for work, but I've never really been to China, India, Thailand. So there's just Vietnam. There's a ton of places I'd love to have a chance to visit. Portugal. I've never been to Portugal. I've never really spent time in Italy. I've been in the airport.
Once.
So yeah, there's a lot of places I haven't been. I apologize, but I had to keep busy.
Yeah, of course.
And, also it's expensive to travel. And when you make documentary films, you don't have a lot of disposable income.
Yeah, of course. And also there's so many adventures you can have at home. I think a lot of people have said they're so upset they can't go, they can't leave the UK this summer. And I just think there's so much you can do with your own home country. You've just got to look.
No, I agree with that. In fact, our garden is just, there's always something going on just in our garden.
Exactly. Even look beyond your backyard, let alone going, across Europe.
Right.
Can you now tell me about the sixth song you'll be taking with you?
So now I'm going to contemporary music. There's a guy called World, W-E-R-L-D, and he's got a song called Upside Down. And it's hard to describe. It's kind of its own genre. And it's kind of... it's a song that is kind of, it's intense. It's an intense song. I don't know, maybe it's a little like trance music, but it's not. And he also makes the video that goes with it, and the video is kind of disturbingly interesting. So, World with an E.
So I've got some more cheesy personality questions. So this one's a all-time classic, but so if you were to have a dinner party and could invite a celebrity guest, could be anyone in the world, dead or alive, any ideas who would be and why?
Celebrities are not my favorite, but I guess celebrity is a broad world word. So dead or alive, that's pretty interesting.
So a previous guest wanted to meet Albert Einstein.
I know the scope of dead or alive. It's pretty big scope. In fact, I don't think I saw that on the list, so I hadn't thought about that answer. But if I had to pick one, I'd certainly like to hang out with Martin Luther King. I mean, he's pretty amazing. I don't know if he'd like to spend an evening chatting with me if he had his druthers, but I certainly would find that fascinating.
Despite doing, I think I've done 40 or 50 of these now. I've not even, thought about answering them myself. Luckily, I'm the one asking the questions.
Yeah. Even if you said people who are living, who would you like to be? There's very few real heroes that are celebrities. The people in this film are everyday heroes with a small h. They're imperfect. And the thing I like about that is that if you have a film with heroes with a big H, then people have a tendency to say, oh, good, the heroes are taking care of this, so I don't have to worry about it. But these are heroes with a very small H, and you see they've got all kinds of the same problems and issues that everyone else has, and so that makes them relatable. Mm-hmm. And so people can say, well, if they're doing that, then I can do something. So, but heroes with a big H, I mean, I wouldn't mind hanging around with Obama for an evening.
I do think those, the politicians who are able to whip up people with the intention of hope, I think are really powerful. Because I think it's very easy to point the finger and blame certain groups for certain issues, and very easy to whip up hate, but to whip up people on hope really takes
power. Very true. Very true.
I think it's just people who, you know, instead of pointing out the problem, they point to the solution. I think that is what really comes with the people who ride on hope, saying if we all pull together, we can make something happen rather than.
Eli Wiesel, after all he went through in the Holocaust, he was very hopeful and positive.
But yeah, so now your seventh song.
My seventh song is also by World. It's a remix of I Touch Myself, which is a, but this is funny. The video is just hilarious. So it's very funny. I Touch Myself by World.
And then I think this is my final one before we move on to the other part of the book and so on. But is there anything you wish you could go back and tell your younger self?
My younger self? probably, yeah. But I guess that's about things you would do differently, sort of, or be prepared for.
Whatever you interpret it as. So it could be advice or things not to do, or things to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly we can all tell our younger selves about climate change because, you know, James Hansen, he warned the United States in 1988 in Congress about climate change. He was the first person, he was head of NASA atmospheric research. And he told people that climate change was coming, and if we didn't do something, it was going to affect everything. And that is, it was interesting because people really listened to him for that first 8-10 years. And then it became this political issue where the Republicans were trying to make sure that it didn't get in the way of fossil fuel extraction. So they claimed it was bullshit, and they claimed it was a lie, a hoax, whatever. But the first 8 years or so, it wasn't a polarizing issue at all. So I don't know what change I could make in that if I knew earlier, but that's something that we could all go back and redo. It would be wonderful.
And now for your eighth and final song.
I have to think about that. I think it would be a song by Amy Winehouse. She's got so many great songs. Which one is the best?
That is a hard one, isn't it?
That was also a powerful documentary on her. Sad.
Yeah, for sure.
Someone should have gone back in her life and told her how she needed to turn that around.
So there's no songs which stand out to you? You're just going to...
Well, I guess I should pick one. I like so many of her songs.
I'll pick a good one for you. We won't tell anyone. Well, I suppose people listening to this back will understand. But, you know... So now it's on to the next part. So you're allowed to take with you the Torah, the Beveridge Report, which is a famous journal which has come out of the London School of Economics, fits with the theme, and a book of your choice. So what is the book you would take with you if you're stranded on a desert island?
Well, if it's a fiction book, it would be The Curator of Broken Dreams. It's a book about three generations in a Jewish family that starts in Smyrna, Turkey, and then goes to Paris, France, then goes to Los Angeles. And if it's a nonfiction book, it'd be 40 Acres and a Mule, which is about Reconstruction. And I think you've heard that after the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln had said that the freed slaves would each get 40 acres and a mule, and it was all set in stone, and they started to arrange that and give some parts of the country to ex-slaves. And then when he was assassinated, he had made a compromise, a stupid compromise, where he had the one Southerner senator who had not seceded from the Union as his vice presidential candidate to try to bring the country together. But of course, this Southerner was a racist. And when he died, he undid that. And, you know, we're paying the repercussions for that now, because even now, because, you know, there was no way to break the cycle of poverty for generations. And so it's a very powerful book.
And what about your luxury item? What would you take with you?
Luxury item. I'd say I'd take fruit trees. You get fruit trees that in the mail, so they're not potted. I forget what they call them. So I would bring a bunch of fruit trees and plant those there. But if it's a desert island, I'd have to figure out some water situation. So I'd have to find a way to turn salt water into fresh water.
But I'm sure, you know, we can make the magical fruit trees which can grow without water. We've had some very obscure items go through, like a limited supply of face cream and a few footballs, surfboard. But no, fruit trees, I think we can definitely allow. And so the next, do you have a favorite meal?
Favorite meal? I don't know that I have a favorite meal. Not sure. Favorite meal. My wife cooks well. She cooks a lot of French food. So maybe some French stew, coq au vin, something like that. Who knows?
Should I take French stew as your favorite meal?
I don't think I have a favorite meal per se. My wife says I will eat any leftover, and I'm not very discerning, but, you know, that'll do.
And then finally, a favorite quote.
Well, I like to quote from the movie where Bill is talking to his daughter, and they're sitting on the couch together, and she's talking about climate change, and she says, "I'm not afraid of change. I don't want to be afraid of change." She says, "Change is inevitable, and change is good." And then she looks at her father, and they're both thinking, change is good? Well, sometimes maybe. And so they both kind of laugh. And he says, well, change is inevitable. But the question is, are we going to be the authors of that change or the victims of the change? And I think that is really what we're struggling with. And if we don't get involved in a big way immediately, then we're going to be the victims of that change, and it's not going to be a pretty picture. But if we do get involved in a big way, you know, globally, it's still possible to be the authors of that change and to make it graceful or possible.
Well, perfect. Well, Joe, thank you very much for giving up time to tell me about your Geography Island Jams.
Well, thank you for having me, and very nice to meet you, Will. And good luck with your radio show, your haircut, and all of that.
Thank you.